Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Kuf Zayin Amud Aleph, two lines down. Itmar, Achim Shechalku, brothers that divided up the estate, Uba Bal Chov, and then a creditor of their father came, Benatal Chalko Shel Achad Mehen, and he confiscated the property of one of them, whether it's the whole property, a portion of the property to repay the outstanding debt. Now that individual wants to get repaid or reimbursed by the other brothers for having to cover the debt that was incurred by their father. Rav Amar Batla Machloket. Rav, similar to his position in the previous case, says that we unwind the previous division and we redivide the property between the brothers. Ushmol Amar Viter. Shmol says that he gives up any rights to collection, and therefore, whatever he lost, he lost. The other brothers are not responsible for that. Ravasi Amar Notel Revia Bekarka or Revia Bemaot. Ravasi says he gets a quarter of Karka, a quarter Maot. So here you have three opinions as to what happens in this situation. First of all, there is a machloket as to how many brothers we're speaking about here. Most of the Rishonim believe that we're talking about two brothers that are splitting the estate. The Rashba quotes from the Geonim that it's speaking about three different brothers that are splitting, and that's also a girsa that is brought by the Rif. As far as the three opinions here, in 1 second, the Gemara will explain each one of the positions. There's one issue that we need to clarify over here, which is, why is it that the Baal Chov, why is it that the creditor of their father went to one of the particular brothers to collect? The obligation is on the estate as a whole, the obligation is on their father, and therefore he should go to all the brothers jointly and not force one of the brothers to pay for the entirety of the debt that is outstanding. The Balei Tosafot over here, in asking that question, suggests that it was a case where there was an apotiki. It was a directed collateral, and the property that stood as the directly collateral for this outstanding debt belonged to one of the brothers. He had taken it in the division of the estate. He had taken that piece of property. The Balei Tosafot also note that it can't be really a full-fledged apotiki or directed collateral, because then he would also only have the ability to take it in karka and not pay off with cash. And so therefore he says it's somewhere in between. Others suggest, like the Ramban, that it has to do with the quality of the property that they took. Remember that a Baal Chov collects from Benonit. Others, like the Ritva, point out that we were talking about Yitomim over here, so you can only collect from Ziborit. But in the way that the estate was divided, one of the brothers ended up with the property that the creditor had a right to go after. And so therefore, either he took the Benonit or the Ziborit, depending on what you think the situation is here. And therefore, the creditor went after him in particular because the level of property that he held was the property that the creditor was allowed to go after. Others suggest that the creditor doesn't have to be bothered to get all the brothers together. He doesn't have to take a piece of property here, there, and everywhere in order to get his loan repaid. He takes the piece of property, and then the brothers have to work it out between themselves. Or each of the brothers is a guarantor to the other brother, and therefore he can just deal with one brother, collect the amount, and have the other brothers themselves settle out between them. So for whatever reason, the creditor went to this particular brother and took the property. The question is now, is he entitled to reimbursement from the other brothers? And how is that reimbursement made? So, well, the Gemara continues and says, Rav Amar Batla Machloket. Rav says that we unwind the original division, and now we redivide the property. Kasavar Achim Shechalku Yorshinhei. Because Rav believes that brothers who split up the property are inheritors. Now, this comes to a more fundamental understanding of what happens when you divide up the estate. There are two opinions as to what happens over here. One possibility is that there is breira. Breira means that once we've divided up the property, we then look at it as if this was what was supposed to happen from the start, and each brother got exact what they were supposed to get as yorshim of the property. In doing so, they remain inheritors of the property because of this concept of breira. Whatever they got was what they were supposed to get. And so what they got was actually their Yerusha. So in splitting up the Yerusha is premised on the fact that there is an estate, and then we're dividing the estate. Over here, where the creditor comes and takes property away from the estate, then we have to redivide so that the Yorshim get the division of property so that they are Yorshim. So that's why Rav believes Batla Machloket is because they are Yorshim. The responsibility of the estate to pay this creditor devolves upon all the brothers. And so now we're going to have to redivide the property in order to make it fair. And that's why he says Batla Machloket. On the other hand, Shmuel Amar Viter. Shmuel says that the brother has no rights of recourse against his other brothers. Kasavar Achim Shechalku L'Kochot Tavu. He believes that the brothers are purchasers or buyers in the division of the estate. That is because Shmuel believes that Ein Breira, that when people divide up something, we don't say retroactively that's what it was supposed to be all along. Rather, there's a bartering transaction that's going on over here. The brothers can never figure out exactly what or which pieces of property and what items we're going to go to each of them. And therefore, they come to an agreement to assess the estate and divide up the assets of the estate. And in dividing up the assets of the estate, in essence, they are bartering their portion for the portions that are given to the other brothers, or they are what are considered to be lukuchot. They are purchasers and sellers to each other. Now, as it becomes clear in the Gemara, Shmuel believes, obviously, they are lokhim shelo b'achrayut. They are purchasers without recourse, meaning that as part of the division of the property, they agree to divide up the property and not hold the other parties responsible for anything that happens to whatever chelek or portion they took of the Yerusha. So there is no indemnification here that says that, okay, you took this property, but we'll make sure that you don't lose out. When they split it up, they split it up. And with the hana'ah and the agreement that we're going to split it up, that consideration, we take responsibility for each brother takes responsibility for whatever that he is receiving. And he doesn't have any ability then to go back to the other brothers in case something happens. That's what Shmuel calls them, lekuchim shelo b'achrayut. As the Rashbam points out over here, even though when you have contracts without achrayut, without recourse in them, we say it's a ta'ut sofer, that's a mistake of the scribe, and it should be there. Nevertheless, in this case, because of the consideration and the agreement to divide up the property in the manner that is concluded between the brothers, or they all relinquish their right to that recourse, and everybody is lokeach shelo b'achrayut. It has nafkamina, many nafkaminot, including whether, when the yovel comes, do they have to redivide the property. If you think that they are yorshim, then when the yovel comes, you keep the property because Yerusha is a steachuza, it's your property and remains your property. But then if you're a buyer, then in the Yovel, all property goes back to the original owner. So here, if the three of them are buyers, or the two of them are buyers, when the Yovel comes, you have to return the property to the pool, and then redivide the assets again, because you only lechuchim. It also have nafkaminot for things like bikurim, where there are opinions that you only bring bikurim when the fruits are grown on property that you are yoresh for, and not on properties that you purchase. So over here, these are purchased properties, and therefore it might have implications with regards to Bikurim as well. So in essence, the machloki between Rav and Shmuel in this situation is whether there is Breira or there's no Breira. The outcome of that machloki is if you believe there is Breira, then they are Yorshim. If they are Yorshim, then when somebody comes along like a creditor and takes from the property, they're all jointly responsible for that, and they have to redivide the property afterwards. On the other hand, if you think there's no Breira, then the outcome of that is that they are considered to be the Kuchot, they are considered to be purchasers. And Shmuel believes that they are purchasers without recourse, as the Rashbam explains, because of the agreement or the Hana'ah that the division is done in the manner that they wanted, they give up their rights to recourse. They are the Kuchot without recourse. And so if the creditor comes and takes from one of them, he is solely responsible for that, and there's no redivision or reassessment of the division of the properties. On the other hand, Ravasi is misvekale iyorshim havu ilukuchot havu. Ravasi is uncertain as to whether the brothers are considered to be yorshim, or whether they're considered to be lukuchot. Hilkach, therefore, notel revia bikarka, revia bimaot. Over here, there are three main opinions as to what Ravasi is saying. We'll go through the Rashbam's opinion first, where the Rashbam says that when it says here, revia bikarka, revia bimaot, he means or revia bikarka, or revia bimaot. You don't get both, you get one of the two. Since over here it's mamon amutal bisafek, we have a safek as to whether he's entitled to reimbursement or he's not entitled to reimbursement. And since over here, according to the Rashbam, we were dealing with two brothers, one brother's property was then confiscated by the creditor, and now he wants his other brother to reimburse him or to redivide the assets of the estate. So each brother had half of the estate. The half that belonged to this brother was then taken by the creditor. So what Ravasi says is we have a safek here. We're not sure you are a yoresh. If you are a yoresh, you would be entitled to full compensation, that you would have to replace the entire half that was gone. On the other hand, if you are considered to be the kuchot, and that means the kuchot shelo b'achrayut, then you'd be entitled to nothing. Therefore, we say he should reimburse him a quarter, which means a half of the loss that he sustained, because mamona mutal b'safek chokim. And therefore, the brother who still has property has now an obligation to reimburse the other brother for a half of his losses, and he can do it in whichever manner he wants. He can either reimburse him with karka, with land, or he can reimburse him with cash. Or the other way to express it is to say that the one who still has property, either half of that property belongs to his other brother, or none of that property belongs to his other brother. So you have a difference between whether half his property or zero of his property belongs to the other brother. It's a mamona mutal b'safek. So we tell him to pay a quarter of his property to the other brother. So that quarter can be paid either in cash or in karka. Because he can say to the brother who paid off the creditor with the land, you had a right to pay off the creditor with cash. You didn't choose to do that, but I would have done that. And since I would have done that, I'm only going to reimburse you in cash. I'm not going to give you karka. You're not entitled to karka. Or, if he doesn't have the cash to do it, he has the right to give it to him in karka. That's the way that the Rashbam reads the position of Rav Asi. The Rashbam over here quotes from Rashi in Baba Kama. The Balei Tosafot also seemingly favor that view. The Rosh Mishnah says he thinks that's a better understanding over here. And the Rabbeinu Gershom, you can see the same thing, also agrees with that version that Rashi brings in the Gemara in Baba Kama. And that is when Rav Asi over here says Revia Bikarka, Revia Bimaot, he doesn't mean either or, but rather both. He has to pay him a quarter in land and a quarter in money. The reason being is that we have a safek here as to whether they are considered to be Yorshim or they are considered to be the Kuchot. But Rav Asi, as opposed to Shmuel, believes that they are the Kuchot Be'achrayut. They are purchasers with recourse. That means that no matter which way you feel, whether you feel they are Yorshim or whether you feel they are the Kuchot, the brother is entitled to compensation over here. So when the creditor confiscated his property, the other brother now needs to make him whole. So he has to give him half of his property so that they redivide the estate in essence, where half the property will remain with this brother, the other half of property will go to the other brother. So there's no question as to the fact that he has to disgorge a half of the property that he took. The question is simply how he has to reimburse him. If they are considered to be Yorshim, then that reimbursement would have to take place through karka. On the other hand, if he are considered to be lukuchot be'achrayut, buyers with recourse, a buyer with recourse has a right to pay off whoever he owes money to with cash. So that's the safek over here. Can he pay him off with cash? Or does he have to pay him off with karka? Since it is a safek, we don't know if he's yoresh or lokeach b'achrayut. Therefore, he pays a quarter of his property in cash, and he pays a quarter of his property with the property itself. So therefore, he's disgorging half of his assets to give to his other brother, so now they are fairly split between them. But the form of compensation is b'safek, and therefore he gives a quarter b'karka because their split might be Yerusha. And it gives them a quarter ma'ot because their split might be because they are the kuchot, but the kuchot shib achrayut. And you can see that in the Rabbeinu Gershom, he says, Klomar, had vaday pshita le ravasi, the chod the kuchot b'achrayutain. Clear to ravasi that if they are considered to be the kuchot, all the kuchot, like we say everywhere else in Shas, that a buyer is entitled to recourse. And even if it's missing from the contract, that's a ta'ut sofer. And therefore, recourse is a part and parcel of being a buyer. And then the conclusion there would be, notel revia bikarka ki yoresh, veria b'maot ki lokeach, that you take both of these items. The Rashbam does not like this explanation, because any time in Shas where you find three Amoraim that argue, or three Tanaim that argue, and then the first one posits a position, the second one posits a position, and the third Tana, the third Amora, says it's a safek between the two previous positions, then that third party takes a portion from each of the two previous positions. And as everybody agrees, Rav believes that they are kiyoshim, Shmuel believes that they are lukuchot shelo be'achrayut, and therefore by definition Rav Asi should be a combination of those positions, which means that it's either a yoresh or a lokeach shelo be'achrayut. The way that you're reading the Gemara now, Rav Asi is not really a portion of the two positions. He's like Rav, in part because he's kiyoresh. He's not like Shmuel, because even though he says he's kelokeach, he's lokeach b'achrayut, which is a totally different category than lokeach shelo b'achrayut. And so the Rashbam sees that as not being the normal way that you present the third position, which is a safek of the two previous positions, and that's why he favors his explanation. On the other hand, as you saw in the Rabbeinu Gershom, where he simply says that it's clear that lokchim in general are lokchim b'achrayut, and the Balei Tosafot bring for the Rosh Mishnah something similar, which is, How do you know when Ravasi says lokeach, that means lokeach shelo b'achrayut? By Shmuel, it's clear because Shmuel says that there's no recourse, there's no repayment over here. On the other hand, for Ravasi, based on his position, you could explain that it's lokeach shelo b'achrayut and it would fit in. And so how do you know it's not a lokeach shelo b'achrayut? And so therefore, many of the Rishonim believe that that explanation that's brought by Rashi and the Gemara in Babu Kama, as well as by the Rabbeinu Gershom over here, and supported by the Bali HaTosafot, is the right way to explain Ravasi, and Revia Maot and Revia Karka is and not or. And so therefore he's giving up half of the value of whatever he inherited to reimburse his brother who got the entire property or entire assets that he was given were confiscated by the creditor. And the difference between Ravasi and Rav will be the nature of how you divide up the property. According to Rav, you do it through Karka, whereas Ravasi, you do it through partly Karka, partly ma'ot, but in the end they both agree that the brother who lost his property to the creditor is entitled to reimbursement. There is a third explanation which I had noted before. It's quoted by the Rashbo in the name of the Geonim, which is that there are really three brothers over here, and Rav Asi's position is the following. He has a safek as to whether they are Yoshim or Lokhim, and therefore it says 50% he's not going to pay, 50% he is going to pay. Even within the position that he is a lokeach, there's a safek whether he's a lokeach b'achrayut or he is a lokeach shelo b'achrayut. And therefore they view it in the following manner. He's entitled to a quarter of reimbursement through karka and a quarter of reimbursement through ma'ot. And so when Ravasi Rear sees Revia, it's not a quarter of what the other brother owns, but rather a quarter of the losses that he sustained over here. The reason being that there is a number of sfeikot over here. There's a safek that he is a yoresh. If he's a yoresh, he was entitled to 100% reimbursement. The possibility that he was a lokeach shelo b'achrayut, and then he'd be entitled to no reimbursement. There's also a possibility that he is a lokeach b'achrayut, and then he would also be entitled to reimbursement, only that it would be with cash. Now, given that articulation of their position, the truth is that he should have only have lost a third of the value of the land that was taken by the creditor, because there are three sfeikot over here. There's a sfeik as to whether he is a yoresh, and he's entitled to full reimbursement. There's a sfeik as to whether he is a lokeach b'achrayut, and he's entitled to reimbursement in cash. Or he is a lokeach shelo b'achrayut, where he's entitled to no reimbursement. So if you take those three possibilities, then that's a third, a third, a third. In two of those thirds, he's entitled to reimbursement, just a question of whether it's karka or ma'ot. And one third, he's not entitled to reimbursement. And so therefore, you would have divided it up and given him a third of the loss in ma'ot, a third of the loss in karka, and one third you would not reimburse, and he would have to sustain the losses himself because of that safek. And even if you articulate it as really being a 50% safek, which is 50% chance that he's a yoresh, 50% chance that he's a lokeach. In the 50% chance he's a yoresh, he's entitled to a reimbursement. So for half of it, he should get reimbursed. And even with lokeach, under that subset, it's a possibility that he's a lokeach b'achrayut, or lokeach shelo b'achrayut. If you do that, then there's another 25% chance that he's re-entitled to cash reimbursement, and he should reimburse for 75% of the losses he sustained. Only the 25% that belongs to lokeach shelo b'achrayut, he wouldn't get reimbursed. So according to the logic of the Gonim, it should work out that Rav Asi should either give him two-thirds reimbursement, half of that in karka, half of that in ma'ot, or give him 75% reimbursement, with 50% being in karka, 25% being in ma'ot. The fact that they say that he's only entitled to half the loss sustained in reimbursement, and a half of that being in karka, and a half of that being in ma'ot, it's very hard to understand their logic. And for that reason, the Rashbo says that he doesn't think that that explanation is correct over here. Although I think you possibly could explain that the Gaonim's logic is the following, which is that either he is entitled to reimbursement or he's not entitled to reimbursement. They see that as a 50-50 shot. There's a possibility he's entitled to reimbursement. There's a possibility he's not entitled to reimbursement. 50-50. Even if he's entitled to reimbursement, we're not sure about how we should be reimbursed. That's a safek as to whether he's yoresh or lokeach b'achrayut. And therefore the half or that entitlement to reimbursement will split between half of it coming in cash and half of it coming in karka. So that's a way maybe to defend that position of the Geonim. But as you see here, most of the Rishonim do not accept that position of the Geonim, but rather explain it either like the Rishbam over here, or like Rashi in Baba Kama. Now the Gemara concludes, Amar Papa, Baba says, Hilchata b'chol hanishmaitata mikamtsin. And all of these memorot that we saw, where we had differing opinions, the locha is mikamtsin. So now, in the previous case that we had in yesterday's daf, where there's a machloket between Rav and Shmuel as to whether a batla machloket, we unwind the division of the property, or we say mikam sin, over there it's clear that Rav Papa is paskening like Shmuel, and says that mikam sin. And that is, when you have shnei achim shechalku, balahen ach mimedinat hayam, over there he's paskening like Shmuel, mikam sin, that the other two brothers have a right to either cut off property and give it to the other individual, or according to the Balei Tosafot, to redo a lottery, but the original lottery still has tokef in the division of the property between the two original brothers. But when it comes to the case that we brought now, Avachin Shechalku, Babal Chob, Natal Chalko, Shechad Mehen, Shmuel does not say Mekamsin. Shmuel says you're totally off the hook. And therefore, the Rishbam explains over here, that Rav Papa in this case must be paskening like Rav, which is that he is entitled to reimbursement, but he disagrees in the method of the reimbursement. The way that Rav states it is that you batla machloket, you unwind the original division, and then you redo the whole division of the property. On the other hand, Rav Papa believes that yes, you're entitled to reimbursement, you are entitled to reimbursement in karka like Rav, but nevertheless, we are going to do it in a manner where it is mikamsin, that the brother who holds the property can decide what he wants to take from his property and give to his other brother. It's up to him to divide up the property or give the value to the brother who lost to the creditor, and we don't reopen the whole division and we don't reassess everything and then do a new division of the property. So that's how we explain Rav Papa. Rav Papa is paskening like Shmuel in the first case of Achim Shechalko, and then their brother shows up. In the case of Achim Shechalko, and then the Baal Chov comes and confiscates the property of one of the brothers, there we paskin like Rav, but not totally like Rav. We don't redo the whole division, but simply the brother who has the property now will disgorge a portion of that property in favor of his other brother, but he can decide how to do it. Amemar amar, but la machloket. On the other hand, Amemar believes that the halacha is like Rav in both instances, both in the case of Achim Shechalku, and then the third brother came from Medinat Hayam, or in the case of Achim Shechalku, and then the Baal Chov, the creditor, came and confiscated the property of one of them to repay the debts owed by their father. In both those cases, the din is like Rav, a but la machloket, and we have to redivide the property now, given the new facts. In the first case, we have three brothers now, so you have to redivide it. In our case over here, you have to redivide the assets because there are less assets in the estate to divide. The Gemara concludes that the halacha is like a meimar, which is that the halacha is like Rav, and therefore we pass on like Rav in both of these instances. As the Balei Tosafot point out over here, that already presents a little bit of a problem. Says Hachamashma the Kaimelan the Yesh Breira mid the Paskinin Kerav. If you pass on like Rav over here, as we began in today's daf, Rav's position is premised on the din of Breira. And that means that we paskin that there is Breira. On the other hand, in many other places in Shas, we seem to paskin that ain't Breira. So the Balei Tosafot in a number of places in Shas try to deal with this issue, both in the Gemara, in Beitza, in Eruvin, and in Gitid, trying to reconcile how in some places we say there is Breira, sometimes we say there's no Breira, and he differentiates between different types of Breira in order to solve that problem, that despite the fact that we paskin ain't Breira, there are certain instances where we do paskin like Rav over here, where there is Breira. Others note that in other places in Shas, not only the Shmuel, but also Rabbi Yochanan believes that Achim Shechalku are the Kuchotein, and when it comes to a machloket between Rav and Shmuel, generally the halacha is like Shmuel Bedine. When it comes to a machloket between Rav and Rabbi Yochanan, the halacha is like Rabbi Yochanan. So why over here is the Gemara Paskin like Rav, when the Klal Yapsak would certainly favor saying that they are the Kuchotein, because that is both the position of Shmuel and Rabbi Yochanan. And so many of the Rishonim answer that when Rav says they are Kiyoshin, he doesn't necessarily mean Kiyoshin in the fullest of sense. He doesn't mean that literally there is Breira and they are Yoshin. He just says that, yes, maybe they are considered to be the Kuchot, but they are going to be the Kuchot with the cloak of Yoresh. Which means that, yes, Ein Ochanami, in the end, they are the Kuchot, because we paskin like Shmuel, we paskin like Rabbi Yochanan. But we're going to overlay on that Rav's idea that they have a din like Yorshim, which means that they do not give up their rights to reimbursement. Or in essence, he's saying that they are Lochin Be'achrayut, and he just dresses that up or says that they are Yorshim, which is that they don't relinquish their right to reimbursement and reimbursement through Karka. And so that it is a division, but a division that has a residual, almost indemnification built into it, that the brothers will protect each other if there is something that is taken from the estate as a whole, and they will give up or disgorge property in order to make whole the brother that suffers that loss because of the indebtedness or the problems of their father from where the estate came. So now the Gemara says, Tarabanan, Shlosha she'adu l'shum echad. Three individuals who came to assess the value of a property. Over here, the way that the Rashbam says it, it's a case where the Beit Din is going to assess the property of Yitomim, and they want to sell off or auction off the property in order to raise funds for Mizonota Isha, Mizonota Banot. So even though they're going to go to auction, we want them to assess the value of the property beforehand. As to why they need an assessment if they're going to auction anyway, there are some who suggest that this is a place where they don't do an auction, and therefore you need the assessment to decide what the value of the property is when you go to sell it to the possible buyers. Or others who say that even in a place where there is an auction, we want to know where we have to push the buyers towards. I would have stated it like this, which is that we want to create a reserve price for the auction. Since we're going to go to auction, we want to know what the minimum price is that we're willing to accept. And therefore we have Beit Din assess it, and then give that assessment price or whatever the price that they conclude as being the reserve that they have to clear in order for the auction to go through. So for that reason, they're in Beit Din looking for an assessment. And now the three judges give their opinions. Echad omer b'maneh. One of them says it's worth 100 dinari kesef. Ushnayim omrim b'matayim. And two of them say that it's worth 200 zuz. Echad omer b'matayim. Or one of them says it's worth 200. Ushnayim omrim b'maneh. And two of them say it's worth 100, but tell yachid b'mi'uto. This is a very simple, straightforward case. You have a majority rules, and that is that if two say that the value is such, and one has a deviant view from that, we don't worry about the one. He's batel to the other two, and the majority will govern over here, achrei rabim la'tot, and therefore we will assess the property or give the property's assessed value at that which the majority says, whether in the first case where it's 200 and in the second case where it is 100. Now, echad omer b'maneh, one of them says it's worth 100 zuz, 100 dinari kesef, v'echad omer b'esrim, and one of them says it's worth 20 sela, v'echad omer b'shloshim says it's worth 30 sela. Now, sela is equal to 4 dinar. So the one who says that it's worth 20 sela or 20 shekel of kodesh means that it's 20 times 4 dinar or 80 dinar. And the one who says 30, it's 30 times 4, that's 120 dinari kesef. So the opinions lay out like this. You have one saying 80 dinari kesef, one saying 100 dinari kesef, and one saying 120 dinari kesef. Nidon bimanet. The Tanakhama believes that we go after the 100. We say that the value that we come out based on this Beit Din is 100. Then we assign the value as being 90. We do some sort of adjustment or assessment between them. And then we divide it into thirds. So the way that we're going to see in the Gemara comes out is that we take the differential between the highest and lowest, which is 40. We divide it by 3 because there are 3 judges over here. That means that each one is a 13 and a third. And then we add that 13 and a third to the lowest price. So it's 80 plus the 13 and a third gives you 93 and a third. The Gemara will explain the logic or the reasoning behind each of these opinions. Mandamar nidon bimaneh. The Tanakamu says that we assume the assigned value here is 100 milta mitziyata. That is the middle of the range. Over here, there is a machloket into the Rishonim as to whether mitziyata means the median price, or it means the mean or the average of the prices that are here. In our case, it turns out that the median and the mean are the same, because you have 80, 100, and 120. So the average price is 100, and the median price, the middle price, is also 100. So in this case, it's not clear, but the Rishonim here argue as to whether it means mean or median. So the Rambam and other Rishonim believe that the number here is an average, and therefore you would go by the highest and lowest and then come into the average. But that average is only determined by the highest and lowest prices. The middle price gets knocked out completely, and the average is an average of the spread between the highest and lowest prices. On the other hand, the Rashbam over here explains that he thinks that it is a median, or the middle price, and he explains the logic over here. Ubedinu de didon kavate b'maneh. It makes sense that the one who's 100 should be the governing price over here. The hatar vayu shel shloshim v'shel maneh modeh d'shaveh maneh. That is because the one who says it's 100 obviously believes it's 100. And the one who says that it's 30 slaim or 120 dinar also agrees that there is a minimum of 100 over here. He thinks there's more, but he at least agrees that there is 100. And therefore you really have a majority that rules. You have two people saying at least 100, and one person saying less than 100. And because of that, you say that the 100 wins or trumps over here, the median price is going to be the one that governs. Vinir and I do a din, and the same thing we true. He says, I think that the din will be the same, that even if the lower price was 20 slaim, which is 80 dinar, the next one was 100 dinar, and the top price was 28 sela instead of 30, which is 112 dinar. He says that I still think that 100 would be the right price. He says, even though that's not the average price, nevertheless, he thinks it still should be 100 because that is the median price. So here you have a machloket as to whether mitziyata is the average. That's what the Rambam says, but not a real average because it's not taking all the positions into consideration. It's only taking the upper and lower ones into consideration. Or it's a median, like the Rashbam says over here, because of the logic of bichlamatayim maneh, that the higher price subsumes at the lower price, and therefore you have at least an agreement that the middle price is believed by two versus the one. Elazar Rebbe Tzadok Omer Nidon B'Tishin. Elazar Rebbe Tzadok says we look at it at 90. Kasavar, he says, Ha'ara Tishin Sheveh. The real value of this land is 90. V'haide Kamar Esrim, and the one who said it was 80, Katoya Saral Achorei. He is undervaluing it by 10 dinar. Behind the Kamar Maneh, and the one who says it's worth 100 dinar, Kataya Sarali Kamei, is overestimating it or overvaluing it by 10 dinarim. And so therefore, we look at the real price being 90. That's the middle price between the lowest and the middle assessment over here. And we want to minimize the deviation from the proper price. According to the Tanakama, you have two people who are deviating from what we think is the right price here, 100, by 20 dinarei kesef. So Rav Elazar ben Tzadok says that's a very large skew between those two opinions. I'd rather limit this skew, and therefore I'm going to say that the real value of the property is 90. And so by doing that, I'm saying that the person who said 80 is only off by 10, but said it's 100 is also only off by 10. And so therefore I think 90 is the real price, and then there's a small deviation between those two opinions. So the Gemara says, Adrabah, what are you talking about? What happened to the third assessor over here, which is the one who says that it is 120? Why don't you say this? Hayara mevasara shabyo. It's really worth 110. Bahai de gamar maneh, and the one who says that it's worth 100, katoi asara lachorei, undervalued it by 10. Bahai de gamar shloshim, and the one who said it was 30 sel or 120 dinar, katoi asara lachamei, overvalued it by 10. Mar says, nokot meu trei kamai biadech. You should keep the first two in your hand, meaning the lower two prices. De mitorat maneh lo mafkile, because they don't leave the value of 100. As Rashbam explains over here, that the one who says 100 agrees that it's worth at least 80. So in the 80 and the 100, they are two opinions that both agree that it's at least 80. But that's why the Gemara then said, Adarabba, you can say the same thing with the one who says 100 and 120, that the one who says it's 120, they both agree that it's a minimum of 100. So then why do you favor saying that the one who says it's 80 and 100 are within the range, and we say the one who's 120 is the deviant price? Why don't you say that the 100 and 120 are the ones that are in the range, and the 80 is the deviant price? So here the Rashbam answers, Klomar, shalividrehem yeshlonomar shakarov the manesh shaveh, avalo maneh bichlal. It is close to 100, but not a maneh itself. Below achar trei batrai, and not after the latter two, shomrim yotermi maneh, that if it's worth more than 100, the tafasta meruba lo tafasta. Because when you go up, you have not succeeded in accomplishing all the opinions. Farei kulam modim. At least all three of these opinions are very leave, shekarov the maneh shaveh, that it's worth close to 100. Hilkach yitain tishim, and therefore you give 90. And so what the Rashbam invokes over here is a principle of tafasta meruba lo tafasta. Tafasta muat, tafasta. That if you try to take the highest price, then you're only vindicating one of the parties, and the other parties are not included in that price. The lower the price that you put in, the closer you are to including all of the possible parties over here. And so in this case, if you say that the price is 90, that means that the 80 was really within range, and he really thought it was 90 as well. The 100 thought it was 90, and even the 120 doesn't disagree that it's a minimum 90. And in that way, we will favor giving the prices 90, not 100, because then the deviation of the other two parties would be too far. So they say it's 90 to minimize the deviation and say that the 80 and 100 were really close. The 120 was out there. But even the 120 agrees it's a minimum of a 90, and therefore we say that 90 is the number. You could have done the same thing with 110, and said then that the 100 and 120 are close to that. The 80 is the deviant price. But in doing that, the 80 doesn't agree to that. The 80 doesn't think that 110 is the price. And so there, that's tafasta meruba lo tafasta. And so therefore, we favor the opinion that says it's 90. That's how the Rashbam explains it. And the Belei HaTosafot say a similar thing. The Yesh Tetfos HaMuat compares HaKuntres, the way that the Rashbam explains it. So the Ramban says over here that he thinks the reasoning is Mishum Dekim Lehu Inche Ben Manet Liyoter Mi Manet Fei Mi Ma Dekim Lehu Bishar Shumot. People know the difference between 100 and more than 100, much more than they know or general assessments. 100 Manet, 100 Dinar, it's a big threshold. It's a number that's a round number and a big number. And therefore, people are much more attuned to assessments or values that are around 100. Because people are careful about what's 100 versus what's above 100. And therefore, over here, we are going to favor those opinions that are below 100 or close to 100 versus those that are above 100, because the difference between 100 and above 100 is much greater than those that are crowded around the area below 100. Crossing over that threshold of 100 is a very big deal, and therefore, someone who's above it is probably the standout opinion. And that's how the Ramban explains as to why we favor the two lower opinions and leave the upper opinion as being the deviant opinion over here. And then we divided the thirds. Kasavre, they believe, hai aro tishin vitlata vitilta shavyo. They believe that the real value of the land is 93 and a third. Hai de kamar esrim, the one who says 20 seller, 80 dinarim, katai tlesar, the tilta of achare. He is making a mistake of an undervaluation of 13 and a third. V'hai de kamar maneh, and the one who's saying that it's worth 100, katoi tleisar v'tilta lekameh. He's making a mistake of overvaluing it by 13 and a third. Obedinu delay matfei. And therefore, he should have said more. Because if you take 93 and a third and you add on 13 and a third to that, he really should have said 106 and two thirds. So then why didn't he say 106 and two-thirds? I can't be that much higher than my friend. It can't be that my number is so much greater than my friend. And therefore, he pulled his number down to 100, or he rounded it off to 100, because even though he was above him, he didn't want to be so far away from him. Gemara says, Adrabba. So why don't you just say it the other way around? You could do the same thing with the other opinions. Hi, Ara. Mea Tlesar Vitilta Shavyo. The real value of the property over here is 113 and a third. Haide Kamar Maneh, the one who says it's 100, Katoi Tlesar Vitilta Achore, is making an undervaluation mistake of 13 and a third. Haide Kamar Shloshim, and the one who says it's worth 30 seller, 120 dinar, Toi Tlesar Vitilta Lekameh, is making a mistake of 13 and a third of overvaluation. Well, 113 and a third plus 13 and a third, he should have said 126 and two thirds. So then why did he say 120? Udenu de gamar tvei, he should have said more. Savar mistai de gamat fina kulihaya chavrai. I'm embarrassed that I'm going so much higher than my friend. And therefore he rounded it down to 120. So the Gemara explains that the Acherim say that it's 93 and a third. And there is a deviation of 13 and a third between the lower valuation and the upper valuation. But the person with the upper valuation pulled his valuation in because he was too embarrassed to go so much above the lower position. And therefore he rounded to 100. Gemara says you could apply the same logic and say that the price was 113 and a third. Say the one who said 100 was giving the value at a diminishment of 13 and a third. The one said 120 didn't want to go so high because he's embarrassed to go so far above the 100 that he rounded it off to 120. The Gemara here answers similarly to what it did before, which is Nakar Mio Tre Kamai Biadech Dimitorat Mea Lo Mafkile. You keep the first two in your hands because they don't move away from Torat Mea out of 100. Again, the way that the Rashbam explains it, Tafasta Muat, Tafasta, Tafasta Meruba Lo Tafasta. But the way the Ramban explains it, at the 100 threshold is a very big threshold. If we keep it below 100, that's normal. If you say somebody went deviant over 100, that's a big change between the level of 100 and above 100, which people don't make mistakes about because it's a significant number to cross over. And so therefore we favor those that are 100 and below versus the one who is above 100. Now over here, there's an underlying assumption that the judges know what the other party is going to say. Because the fact that he was embarrassed to say his number is because he knew what the other party was going to say and he didn't want to be so far above him. So the Rashbam asks on that, how does he know what his friend's going to say? When the judges go to give their positions, They don't have any idea what the other judge is going to say. So what the Rashbam says is, despite the fact that they state their opinions later, it doesn't mean they don't know what the other judge is going to say. They have been deliberating this issue for a long time. And so they have a sense of where the other party is going to come out. And therefore, when they state their opinion, they're doing it with the assumption of knowing or having the knowledge of the deliberations as to where they think their friend's going to come out. And they don't want to deviate from it so dramatically. On the other hand, the Balei HaTosafot simply say, Shekeinah Seder, the Shnayim HaPochtim Idabrim Techila. But the Balei HaTosafot would say that in the end, it's the ones with the lowest valuation go first, which is that we go from lowest to highest. What the Balei HaTosafot don't explain necessarily is, how do we know who the lowest is to go from the lowest to the highest? And that really brings you back to the Rashbam's position, which is, because of the deliberations, we have a sense of where they're going to come out. You may not know the exact number, maybe that's what the Balei HaTosafot are referring to, that when you go from lowest to highest, then you really do have the exact number, and the ones after them might adjust their number to account for the fact or the number which the lower one gave as the assessment. So in conclusion here, we have three different ways to assess the field when the three judges come up with three different prices, one at 80, 100, 120. We have the Tanakamo who believes that it's mitziyoto, it's either the mean or the median price. We have Rabbi Eliezer b'Rabbi Tzalok who says we have an average of the lower two prices, which makes it 90. And then we have the opinion of the Acherim who say that it is 93 and a third because of the division of the differential between the highest and lowest prices into a third, the number of Dayanim that are over here, and adding that on to the lowest price. Amar Rav Huna, halacha ke Acherim. Rav Huna says the halacha is like the Acherim. Amar Rav Ashi, taima da Acherim lo yadinan hilchata avinan kavatayu. I don't understand the logic of the Acherim. And given that, now you're telling me that the halacha is like them? How are we going to pass an halacha like them if we don't even understand the logic that is behind their position? So even though we already explained the logic or the reasoning behind the position of the Acherim, what the Rashbam says, Rav Ashi is saying, is lo mistaber tamayu. Their logic or their explanation doesn't make so much sense. So Rav Ashi is rejecting their logic as to how they came to their number. On the other hand, the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom reads it is, what does it mean? Lo yadinim mishum deikalak shu'elayu kedemakshinu nadarabah. We had that question on them, that why are you picking 93 and a third? You could have picked 113 and a third because of the adarabah. And even though the Gemara gave an answer to that question, Rav Ashi doesn't see that as being a proper answer or a sufficient answer. Mishum hachi amar tayim adachim lo yadinan. Says, I don't know their logic or their understand their reasoning. Not that it's necessarily logical, but he doesn't understand why you would pick 93 and a third versus 113 and a third. So for that reason, Rav Ashi says, I don't think the halacha should be like the Acherim. Tanu Dainei Gola, the Dainim of the Gola, and as the Rabbeinu Gershom notes over here from the Gemara and Sanhedrin, we saw this earlier in the Masechta as well, the Dain of the Gola is Shmuel v'Karno. So Shmuel and Karno said, Osim Shuma b'neihem umshalshim. You do exactly like what the Acherim say. Am Rav Huna hilchotak yedayenei gola. Rav Huna here says, similar to that he said before, halacha ke Acherim. He says the halacha is like the dayenei gola, who are like the Acherim. Am Rav Ashi, taima de dayenei gola lo yadinan. I don't know the reasoning behind the dayenei gola. Hilchotan avinan kavatayu, and we're going to paskin like them? So again, whether he means that he doesn't subscribe to their logic, or he thinks that there is a question as to why their reasoning or logic leads to 93 and a third versus 113 and a third, he rejects it. The Rashbam over here asks, why is it the Gemara doesn't ask here, like it asks in many places where you have two statements from individuals, why do you need both statements? You have Rav Huna saying twice that the halacha is like the Acherim and then halacha ke dayenei gola. Why do you need it to be repeated? So the Rashbam notes over here that the Gemara only asks that if the statement is made about totally different cases, or cases that are not exactly the same, and then they're giving you a halachic outcome or an opinion that really seems to indicate the same thing. Over there, the Gemara will say, why did you need to bring it to me in two different contexts? And in this case, Rav Huna is making a statement about the exact same language. You have the language of the Acherim, the language of the Dayanei HaGola, which are identical. Or in essence, maybe Achad Michlal Chaverta. The reason Rav Huna says Allah is Gedanei Gola is because we heard him say Allah is Gedanei Acherim. It's not like he said it in two different contexts or he said it in two different times. Maybe they only said it once, but we apply Rav Huna to both of them because they're saying the exact same thing. So in that case, the Rashbam says the Gemara doesn't ask, why do we need Rav Huna to repeat his position? And that's why the Gemara just repeats the same thing over again without asking why there is its richuto over here. So now the Gemara continues and Mishnah says, Omer lechaveiro, person who says to his friend, Chatzisa de ani mocher lecha, I'm selling you a half of a particular field. Mishamnim b'nehem, we work out between them. Vinotel chatzisa deyu, and he takes a half of the field. The Gemara will explain what this means in the Mishnah. You would have thought it was simple to understand what half the field is, but as we're going to see in the Gemara, it gets more complex because of the second half of this Mishnah. And because of that, the Gemara has an explanation, which then the Rishonim try to decide what the Gemara meant. Chetzi b'darom ani mocher lecha. I'm selling you the half of the property on the southern side. Mishamnim v'nehem v'notel chetzia b'darom. Again, they do some sort of assessment between them, and he takes the southern half. V'hu mikabel alav makom geder charitz uben charitz. And he accepts upon himself the placement of the fence, the placement of the ditch or the moat, and the smaller moat. The Mishnah uses a dangling modifier, v'hu, and he accepts the responsibility. The Rashbam reads it as that the mocher, the seller over here, accepts the responsibility to put up the fence and to put up the ditches or moats around that fence to prevent the animals from getting into the property. V'hu mikabel alav is referencing to the mocher. Whereas the Rambam in the Perush Mishnayot says that v'hu refers to the koneh, to the buyer. He has the responsibility to put up these items in his property. V'kamahu charitz, what is the size of this ditch or moat that goes around? Shisha tvachim. Uben charitz, and the ben charitz is half that size, which is shlosha, is three tvachim. And again, the Gemara will explain everything that just happened in the Mishnah. Amar b'chir ba'av, amar b'yochanan. Lokeach notel kachush shebo. The lokeach gets the lesser of the properties. Amar le b'chir ba'av, le Rabbi Yochanan. So b'chir ba'av says to Rabbi Yochanan, va'anan mishamnim b'neyem t'nan. Doesn't our Mishnah say that you are mishamein between them, that you divide it up between them? Why are you suggesting here that the buyer gets the lesser or the weaker of them? It should be that they get the exact equal amount, because our Mishnah says mishamnim b'nehem, that they divide it up between them. So Amar Lei, so Rabbi Yochanan says back to Rabbi Chir Bava, ad achlat kafnaita b'bavel, instead of eating all those dates that are in Bavel, targimna miseifa. You should have figured out that the meaning in the Reisha can't be what you're suggesting, and you have to look at the Seifa of the Mishnah to understand that. The way that Rabbi Chir Bava is reading the word Mishamnin means that you split it between them, you divide the property between them, and in dividing the property between them, why is there a weaker side or a stronger side? They have to make it equal, and then they just take half the property. That's what the Mishnah seems to say. The Yochanan says that can't be the explanation in the first half of the Mishnah, because of the second case of the Mishnah doesn't allow for that type of understanding. And so he pokes fun, or he chastises Rabbi Chir Bava, that you are luxuriating yourself on those dates in Bavel, because he was a Talmud of his from Bavel, and therefore that's why you don't know the answer to this question. But I, who looked into the Mishnah and know what's happening over here, if you look at the Seifa, it's going to give an explanation to the Reisha, and that's why my statement that Lotel Kachush Shibo. And that is Diktoni Seifa, Chetzia b'darom ani mocher lecha. The half in the south I'm selling to you. Mishamnim b'nehem b'notel chetzia b'darom. Then they divide it up between them, and he takes the half in the south. By my mishamnim b'nehem. Why do you have to do any sort of division? All you have to do is give him half the property that's on the southern side. They defined what he's getting. Why is there a statement of mishamnim b'nehem in the Mishnah? So mishamnim b'nehem can't mean what you think, which is to divide it up equally, because it's already a given in the second half of the Mishnah, which is chetzi shibidarom. You just take the measuring rule, you figure out where the halfway line is on the property, and you cut the property in half. If that was the case, then why do you need mishamnim b'nehem in the latter half of the Mishnah? So ela amarlei, ela d'dmei. It must be that it is a monetary assessment. Hachanami d'dmei. So too the ratio of the Mishnah must be a monetary assessment. The way that the Rashbam explains it is that Rabbi Chir Bava believed that Mishamnim b'nehem means that they split the field. You just take a measuring line, figure out where the halfway point is, and then you give it to him. Rabbi Yochanan says if that's the case, then the Seifa of the Mishnah doesn't make sense. What does it mean, Mishamnim b'nehem? And then he gets the southern half. Of course he gets the southern half after they split the property in half, because that's exactly what he said. So then what's the Chiddush in the Seifa of the Mishnah? It must mean that there's another form of division that's taking place here, and it's not premised on the measurement of the size of the field, but rather the value of the field. So the way that the Rashbam explains it is that we look at the total value of the field, and then we say, split the value in half. So say, for instance, that the value of the field is 100. We're going to take the field and divide it into two portions of 50. Now, 50% of the value doesn't mean necessarily that you're getting 50% of the area of the field. And that is because, many times, there are different qualities of property that are in the field. And so therefore, if you have lower quality property, you're going to have to give more of that property to get up to the halfway level of the value of the field. And so that's what Rabbi Yochanan is saying is going on over here. The assessment is based on a valuation of the field. And so what you do is you value the entire field, and then you split that value in half. You'll have then a possibility that half the value is coming from poor quality property, more of it, but poor quality property, and half it is coming from higher quality property. You'll get less of it, but it's more expensive, and therefore you'll get the higher quality property that equals up to 50% of the value. And what the Mishnah is saying is that the mocher, the seller, has the upper hand over here, and therefore he can say to the lokeach, you take the weaker half. So even though we're both getting that same value, he can say to the buyer, you take the 50% that includes within it the weaker part of property, and I'm going to take the 50% that's the stronger property. And as the Rishbam notes, people would much rather have idit, higher quality property with a smaller area, rather than have lower quality property over a larger expanse. So the mocher gets to make that decision because the yad lokeach is ala tachtona, and that's what the Mishnah is saying, is mishamnim neim, you assess the value. And then the qualification that is brought by Rabbi Yochanan on the Mishnah is that lokeach notel kachushbo, that the lokeach gets the worst of the two properties over here because his yad is ala tachtona. And similarly, the Rashbam explains that the second half of the Mishnah, which says chetzi bidarom, it doesn't mean the half of the physical property in the south, but rather it means how much is the property in the south worth. You value the property in the southern half of the field, and then you take that value, and the mocher can give him property anywhere within the field that equals that value. So you'll have the same qualification again, which is that he can give him a kachushibo, give him the weakest or the worst of the property in the field, because he'll assess the value of the southern half, then give that value up in other parts of the field. He doesn't have to give him the southern part. The southern part was just to tell us where to value it, rather than the location as to where he's giving him the property. And therefore, according to the Rashbam, the shmishamni means the shuman, the fat, or the excess value. And that's what it means, mishamnim b'nehem, which is that we assign the value, and then the fatter part, or the better part, goes to the mocher, and the lokeach ends up with the worse half. But mishamnim b'nehem is that they have to work out the difference in that fattiness, which is that the mocher who took the better quality property is going to get less of it, and he has to make that up to the lokeach by the buyer by giving him more of the lower quality property. There are other opinions over here that say that when we say chetzi b'darom or chetzi of the field, it literally means half of the field. But then you have to do something to make up for the differential in price. And you can see that in the Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom says, Olam chetzi b'darom nital. He takes the half in the southern side. B'maya ziborit. If it's low quality property, inechei min adamim. He has to lower the purchase price. B'im yesh lo idit. If he has better quality property in the south, yagzir lo lokeach me'ot, then the buyer will have to pay him more money for it. Hachanami, similarly, the olam lokeach notel kachush, v'nechei lo min adamim, v'mashu pachot v'haino mishamnim. So the word mishamnim over here means, now rather than being the fat, like the Rashbam says, Rabbeinu Gershom is saying that mishamnim means that we do a assessment or a valuation of what he's getting. And so what the demay means is that there's a price adjustment based on it. So just like in the latter half of the Mishnah, when he gives him the southern side, he has to assess the value and then either pay more or less depending on what the value of that half is. So to in the ratio, they're going to split the field in half. Then they're going to take an assessment of the value of the field and half the value and see whether he got less or more than he should have gotten based on that value. And they'll have to either add in money or get a refund for that differential. So that's the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it, which is that literally there is a split here of the property in half, but then there is an assessment afterwards to determine whether that half is really half the value of the property, and we'll adjust the price based on that. But in all these instances, the lokeach will get the worst of the properties. So in the ratio, he'll get the lower of the qualities, but then he'll get a refund based on the fact that he took the lower quality half of the property. Or in the south, no matter what it is, whether it's better quality or lower quality, he gets to take it because he said the southern side. But then he'll have to adjust the price for the differential in quality. He'll have to raise the price if it's better quality or lower the price if it is lower quality. There are other views in the Rishonim, but the one that is most outstanding is the Balamor, who suggests over here that what it means is you get a half of the property no matter what the value is. That means that in the ratio, you get half the property, and if he gives you the half that has the lower quality property, too bad. You pay the half the value of the entire property, And then you get whatever the mocher gives to you, whichever half he decides he wants to give to you. And similarly in the south, you get the southern half. Even though you're paying for half of the value of the entirety of the property, you still only get the southern half, and there it's whether it's worth more or less than half the value of the property. You get what you get, and there is no reconciliation between half the property and half the value of the property. And he explains the word mishamnim b'neihem means that there is going to be a differential in price over here. There will be a difference between half the value of the entire property and half the area that is given to the buyer. And that's in the ratio, it's definitely going to be to his detriment, because of course the seller will give it to his detriment. In the sefer, where it's chetzi l'darom, it could work out in either direction, whether to his benefit or to his detriment, but we give him half the property, no matter whether it is equal to half the value of the entire field. So now the Gemara continues to explain the latter half of the Mishnah, which is, mekabel alav makom geder. Ta'ana. We have a bright that explains, charitz mi bachutz, uben charitz mi bifnim. That the charitz, which is 6 tefachim wide, has to be further out, and the ben charitz has to be closer in than that. Vezeh vezeh achorei hageder, and both of them are outside the fence. So your defense line is the following. From inside the field, you put up a fence first. Outside the fence, you'll then have this ben charitz, this smaller ditch, or dry moat. And then after that, you'll have the larger dry moat or ditch of 6 tefachim. And the Gemara wants to understand, why do you need this? So that the animals can't jump onto the fence and then into the field. So the Gemara says, V'lavid charitz, v'lo lavid ben charitz. Why don't you just put a dry moat outside the fence? And that would be sufficient. You'll have a dry moat or ditch that's 6 tefachim wide. Then you'll have the fence. And that'll be the protection for the field. Where it says, I did the ravach, kaima migavei v'kavsa. Since the charitz is so wide, there's enough of a base where the animal could enter into the base of the dry moat and then jump from the base of the dry moat onto the fence. So lavid ben charitz. So then just make a ben charitz, which is shorter. It's only 3 tefachim wide. And in that case, he won't have enough space to plant himself in there. But lavid charitz. And then you won't need the larger span or dry moat. I did the cut-in, kaima sfatei v'kofsa. Since it's so narrow, it's only 3 tefachim wide, he's going to stand on the edge of it, and he'll be able to clear the distance of the 3 tefachim and jump onto the fence. V'kama ben charitz, the ben charitz. How much space do you need between the charitz and the ben charitz? Tefach, you need 1 tefach. So now, to understand what's happening over here, you have 3 different protections that are put up. Coming from the outside, you have a very deep ditch, which is 6 tefachim wide. Then you have a tefach of regular level land. And then you have another ditch or dry moat that is 3 tefachim wide. So the Mishnah gives you the design of a protection to stop animals from entering into the field. You have a ditch or dry moat around that is 6 tefachim wide. Then beyond that, you have a tefach of level land. Beyond that, you have another ditch or dry moat that's 3 tefachim. And then you'll have a fence. The purpose of the dry moats is to obviate the need to raise the fence so high that the animals can't get over. By digging down the ditches, you prevent the animals from getting over the fence, or in essence, you raise the level of the fence without actually raising the physical fence. Now, the Mishnah and the Braita never tell us what the depth of the ditches are. The Ritva claims that the depths are equal to their width. That means that the charitz, which is 6 tefachim wide, is also 6 tefachim deep, and the ben charitz, which is 3 tefachim wide, is 3 tefachim deep. What ends up happening here is that they create this dry moat that doesn't allow the animal to jump onto the fence. And so they put this wider one outside so that the animal is far enough away from the fence that he can't jump from there onto the top of the fence. Because even though it's 6 tefachim wide and he could sit at the base of that ditch and then try to jump from there, he's still too far away from the fence because there's another tefach of land, and then another 3 tefachim of the second ditch that's there. On the other hand, he walks through the ditch, the outer ditch, and then climbs into the ben charitz, the shlosha tefachim. There's not enough of a base there, or a flat base there, for him to jump from there up onto the fence, and so he won't be able to do that. He might jump from the border or the side of that ben charitz, which was the worry when you didn't have a charitz, only a ben charitz. He could jump from the outside of it because the jump would allow him to cross at least 3 tefachim wide and then get on top of the fence because that's not so wide. So that's why we have the charitz, the outer moat, that doesn't allow him to have a border or a flat space to jump from. There's only a tefach, which is very small between the two charitzim. And so now you have something that's too far away from the fence for him to jump up onto, and not enough flat area within the ditch to allow him to create a base to jump from, because there's still a distance between that wider ditch and the fence because of the smaller ditch on the inside. And so that structure will prevent the animals from entering into the field. And again, as we said in the Mishnah, the way the Rashbam reads that, that's the obligation of the mocher to put that up to protect the field of the buyer. On the other hand, the Rambam believes that's the obligation of the buyer to do that in order to protect his own field. Or if it is the fence between the fields, it would be his obligation to prevent the animals from going from his field into the seller's field. Although the Ritva believes that these requirements are only on the outside facing towards the Rishut HaRabim, not necessary between fields that are together in a Bika. Okay, with that, we're going to end the seventh parak, Adron Halach, Beit Kur.